Hello and welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast. Today we're talking about Good Will Hunting, the 1997 drama that our patron executive producers selected for us to cover today. We're on a bit of a Robin Williams kick, it would seem, Jim.
Sure.
It's directed by Gus Van Sant, who did Drugstore Cowboy, Milk, as well as Finding Forrester, which I remember that movie being good, but God, how can it be with the meme?
I don't know.
No way.
It's been a long time, man.
Sean Connery teaching a black kid how to write with a typewriter. That's a story. There's no way that can be good. There's no way that holds up.
No.
Written by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Lifelong friends. They met at age 8. Grew up together. Went through the same schools together. Wrote a movie. Won some Oscars together here. It stars Robin Williams, the late great. We just saw him in Insomnia. Like I said, we're on a bit of a Robin Williams kick. He's great in this. Matt Damon, we just talked about him in Ocean's 11. Ben Affleck, you know, we try to stay away from Ben Affleck. Haven't done, not a lot. Just,
people do in general, I think.
Not a lot of Affleck in our catalog. Did we do Argo? I'm thinking that might be the only good movie of his that we've covered. Well, there you go. That was decent. Stellan Skarsgård's in this movie. He's a big part of why this season of Andor was kind of amazing. Minnie Driver, what a cutie. What a cutie in this film. I loved her in Gross Point Blank. She was Jane in the animated Tarzan, starring Phil Collins. And Casey Affleck gets a start in this movie. Will later win an Oscar, this bastard, for Manchester by the Sea. I've seen this movie a couple of times before. I haven't seen it probably in the last decade, and I remember really, really liking it and admiring it. And this is a pretty well-loved film. It's like 97% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Although I do think that as I get older and I look back with perhaps the wisdom of age, I understand why Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars instead of 4. Because I remember back in the day, that was one of the kind of things that stuck in my craw. I was like, come on, Roger, what the fuck? You're not going to give this movie 3 stars. You're too good to give an Oscar-winning thing. You know, it was like, why? You just read his reviews, like, why? Why? Like, what? So I'm curious about what you think of this film.
I like it a lot. I've only seen it one other time, and it was, decades ago. When I was closer in age and mentality to the Good Will Hunting character than I was to the Robin Williams character. And yeah, as I age more into the Robin Williams role in this movie, I don't know. I think the movie gets maybe better. I don't know. The first time I watched this movie, I don't remember being as affected by some of the very powerful scenes of Will having like breakthroughs. And this time around, I was much more affected by it. And I think that just comes down to like having experienced some of the things that he must experience, and he doesn't understand them, but, and I didn't understand them back then, but I do now. So I think it's just gotten better, but that's me.
Yeah. There's a whole thing. There's a lot of stuff that I really like. In this film, and I think the script is pretty good. There's a couple scenes, like there's 4 or 5 scenes that are really stand out in dialogue, and they express something that feels real. And they're extremely well performed. I think honestly, Ben Affleck, if I can walk back some of my shit talking about him, I think he's good. Like I see why people can hate him, because there's a couple smirks he gives that are
He looks like a shithead in this movie.
They're like 50 megaton warhead smirks that just want you just want to grab a pipe and beat every tooth out of his face. But he's really good. That scene where he shows up for Will towards the end of the movie and he goes through like a whole range of emotions. Like, you know, it's a long scene where he carries just with physicality. And I also admired his, because I, you know, I know where this is going, and I'm looking at his reactions to Will throughout this movie.
Yeah.
And they're really subtle and they really support the rest of the writing and performance. But I do think that the big flaw of this movie is that the young men writing it, because I know there's a theory that, was it, who was it?
Goldstein, William Goldstein.
Yeah, William Goldstein. Ghost wrote this movie, and he's kind of like leaned out of that rumor, depending on, you know, the interview, and sometimes even in the same interview, he flips back and forth. I don't buy it for this reason. This script feels like guys who had cobbled together this stuff from like Will himself. You know, Robin actually says, points this out. They cobbled this stuff together from things they'd read and from songs they've heard, but they didn't have a real personal experience with. And some of it, I think that they did. Like, I guess I read that Ben's father is an alcoholic, so I think that a lot of that stuff rang true. Yeah, but some of the relational, aspirational stuff is like, I don't think it comes from a real place of lived experience. It comes from a place of kind of like imitation, which is great. And honestly, it's super smart for that place in their life. It's just, you know, not quite there. Like if they wrote this movie in their, you know, right now, it would probably be a 4-star movie, but there's a little bit of lack of polish, but I think that's also charming too.
Well, and to go kind of in the other direction with it too, this is one of those just so movies where everything is very obviously scripted out and you can see where the callbacks are going to be before they even happen. And then, of course, they happen, you know, right up to the final scene. So, like, yeah, it feels a little bit artificial in those moments when you're realizing when you're seeing the mechanics of the movie. And that's a lot of what I was seeing here. But those performances, and I want to say, like, Robin Williams, going back and exploring some of his catalog, has very quickly become like super impressive to me. He won an Oscar for this movie for his supporting role. And I think it's well deserved. He is. And it's so different. We just watched Insomnia, where he plays like a guy where his, you know, manic Robin Williams energy is kind of bubbling just under the surface.
Yeah.
I don't feel that in this movie. He's able to entirely ditch that and bring something completely different and very powerful to the role, and something that was necessary, I think. So I'm super impressed with Robin Williams nowadays.
Yeah, the way you described it, like the insomnia, that the Robin Williams mania was bubbling underneath that character. This, it feels like a tide that has just receded.
Yeah.
You're like there was a tsunami inside Robin Williams. It pulled all the zany back.
Uh-huh.
And he's
to bust into Patch Adams or something. I don't know.
Well, no, there's like this feels like a real life, three-dimensional, colorful character who's had the life drained, like the color drained out of him. And you get that because, like, I don't know if we subconsciously bring it because, like, we expect Robin Williams to be big and we're expecting him to have, like, the big funny moment and it never comes. But, like, it's hinting, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, love stories in here. It's not just Minnie Driver and Matt Damon. There's also Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, but there's also Stellan Skarsgård, Robin Williams. And you can start to see the Robin Williams we know peek out underneath those clouds at the end, because he's, you know, that's another elegant structure of the movie. He's healing himself and his relationship with his friend as he's also healing this kid from Boston. Yeah, Robin Williams is really, really good. And everything he does services the plot so well, you know, because like, again, we're taking in all the stuff we know about him and he's defying our expectations.
Yeah. But I don't know if I had a complaint with the movie, I'd say it's probably a little too rote, a little too just.
Especially in the first act, like some of the stuff, like, because this is essentially a nerd's version of Arnold Schwarzenegger film. Like Arnold comes in,
the
like
bulging brain on him.
Yeah. I'm going to kick your ass and humiliate you, and there's nothing you can do about it physically. Like Matt Damon is like that with his brain.
Yeah.
He just like, there's like, you know, essentially Bennett from Commando gets up and tries to humiliate Ben Affleck in a bar in front of Minnie Driver. And he fucking, there's the armoring scene from Commando only in Ben Affleck's brain. And he comes and
Then he electrocutes him and puts a pipe through his chest. Yeah,
exactly. Philosophically, through the lens of 17th century American capitalism.
Yeah,
16th century, I guess. No, but that's the stuff that feels like the most like, oh, you constructed this guy to be a straw dummy for Matt Damon to destroy. You constructed this scene, you know, these therapists as these kind of like very stereotypical and you know, bullshit versions of therapists for for Matt Damon to outsmart and destroy you. You know, some of that stuff, right. you did. Yeah, it's you can smell the set paint, you know, like it's really fresh on that stuff.
And it's funny because like the scene that I remembered from this movie, having not seen it in maybe almost 20 years, is sure. that scene where he demolishes this smart Harvard kid in the bar. The how about them apples thing. That's what I remembered from this movie. That's not the standout scene for me anymore. I mean, it's
right.
It's kind of a cheesy scene at some point.
But
the ones I remember now are like the it's not your fault scene, right? The strong, like yeah. emotional core of this movie that is way better than, you know, some of the flashier things it's doing.
Yeah, no, and it's because, you know, as a young man, that's like your fantasy. Honestly, a lot of if you're not, you know, as a young man, I know I'm not a stereotype. All of us, some of you guys are clearly more elevated beings than us. But like our minds revolve around sex and whatnot. Sex is mostly domination. Like, oh, my God, wouldn't okay. it be cool to just fucking flex on the whole world? And Matt Damon kind of does that. And the thing, this is where yeah. he's a little bit of a Gary Stu. Which is the male yes. version of a Mary Sue, because he doesn't even have like he's not even frail. Like uh-huh. he backs this ponytail wearing fuck the off mm-hmm. mentally. And then when the guy feels a certain way about it, he steps to him physically and is like, I can also, you know, split your ass in half that way. So it's like there's yeah. he has no weaknesses. But the film gets much stronger as they start showing, you know, what a flawed, tragic character he is. But yeah, the first act is kind of rough. And you got it exactly right. Like all the things I thought were awesome about it, oh God, that's kind of cringe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think I especially as a father, of a teenager, like I feel like I have Stellan Skarsgård and Robin Williams having that argument in their office in my head all the time.
Uh-huh.
Like, yep. you can't crush the boy with expectations, eh, Ron? But how will he learn to be a man if you don't? Well, did that work for you? I don't fucking know. I'm making this. So, like, I really appreciate. Yeah, like that stuff, like, really. I wasn't even on my radar. I was just like watching guys, old men yelling at the sky when right, I was like 25. Right. But like, I feel all that now. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate it a lot more. Is there any like opening shots? Any more opening shots, or we should get into the kind of spoiler section?
Yeah, I think we should tell people what it's about and do some spoilers.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move. Yeah, if you don't know, Good Will Hunting is about Matt Damon. He is a Southie. He's from an underprivileged situation in Boston. He grew up an orphan. He's been in and out of bad foster situations. He's best friends with Ben Affleck. And he hangs around with a bunch of self-described losers that do blue collar work and heavy drinking and shitting on rich kids. And he gets in a fight. He gets arrested. And professor, he's also a He's also a janitor at Harvard. And he has been secretly solving advanced math equations left on the chalkboard at night. And the day that the professor discovers it's him, he gets arrested, and this professor intervenes, and he agrees to go into a program where he is mentored by the professor and seeks therapy for his anger issues and abandonment issues. And if he does that, they'll defer his prison sentence. Will be able to overcome his tragic background, his vast oceans of trauma within, and learn to connect to other human beings, or will he shove every positive influence out of his life for the rest of his life until Ben Affleck apparently will beat him to death sometime in his mid-40s? Right. That's the stakes. That's the stakes. That's the stakes of this movie.
Don't expect an answer to that question either, because the movie... Here's the one other complaint I have, is the movie stops right when things are getting important for Will.
Isn't that good, though? Like,
it is. It's 100% the way you do this movie. But if you're looking at a real person's life, this movie is kind of done with it when the hard part begins, I guess. Mm.
True.
So, like, I don't know. I don't know if it answers the questions you asked.
Because, like, yeah, a couple rounds of tough therapy with Robin Williams, as awesome as that does sound.
And it's having a peaks and valleys, man. Great, but, like,
it's peaks and valleys. Yeah. But you know what? If you want to see the rest of his story, watch BoJack Horseman.
Okay. All right.
pretend Ben Affleck is a horse and he moves to California to be with Minnie Driver. And that relationship flames out, because of course it does. And he gets into Hollywood and, oh my God, there's drugs, and there's alcohol, and there's severe crippling depression and neurosis. And yeah, watch BoJack Horseman. That's the rest of the story if you want to see the realistic mental health journey there.
I watch all Ben Affleck movies pretending he's a horse. Is that not a normal thing?
Is that the animal that I see Ben Affleck? What is Ben? Yeah. He's like more of a weasel, right?
It's a bit of a weasel, but he's got that long face, especially with his haircut, where he just kind of stacks hair on top of his head. I feel like it elongates his face in a way that is unflattering.
Yeah, it's like the crew cut version of a flock of seagulls.
Yeah,
like if the military approved flock of seagulls as a haircut, this is what it would look like.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, we are just bagging the fuck on Ben Affleck here. That's all right. It's like he's going to listen to this podcast. It's going to be the smoking on his front steps meme. Like, oh, God. Oh, are these up and cars? He's amateur podcasters talking about Good Will Hunting. I wonder what they thought. Oh, shit.
I hope he has better things to do at this time.
The other thing about I want to talk about some other things I found funny about the film. While we're talking about, while we're bagging on things, what the fuck is with the mathematicians in this movie? They are like either rock stars on par with Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. Like, they're fucking all the bitches. They're, you know, wearing cashmere. I mean, like, you know, Stellan Skarsgård acts like he is Prince in this movie.
Yeah.
And then so you're either that, or you're Ben Affleck, or not Ben Affleck, you're Matt Damon, or you are apparently an emotionally fragile wreck that if some kid solves your math equation you've been working on for years, instead of being elated that, like, the state of math has moved forward, you just like, it's a crippling thing. That's, I don't know. It's like, it's, I feel like this seems like a very dumb person's idea of what mathematicians are like.
Yeah, probably. I don't really know. I don't know a lot of high level mathematicians, but sure.
Did Matt Damon, film student at Harvard, get bullied by the Harvard math department?
Maybe.
Did Click and Clack hurt him? I want to know.
Maybe he had, I don't know, maybe he had that bar experience, except with math. Maybe he was the guy who was trying to, you know, flex his brain on the kid, and the kid just put him in his place, said, oh yeah, can you solve Pythagorean theorem? And he was like, shit, I haven't read that yet.
I think one of the things I initially appreciate about this movie is it explores all the various ways people can be strong, you know, because I feel like, especially for men, we prize like physical strength and bravado. We definitely prize like STEM type applied science, knowledge, intellect, that kind of thing. Not so much emotional intelligence. And that shows like that's the kryptonite for this character is that he's very physically strong. He's very physically tough. He's mentally strong. He's mentally tough. But emotionally, he has no foundation and he's just twisting in the wind to the extent that like if he gets a situation where he starts to feel genuine love, it burns him like sunlight burns an orc.
Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, his they come out and they say it in this movie. He's got I forget what the exact term is, but basically trust issues. And it makes a lot of sense given his background. You know, I bet he views acknowledging emotion as a weakness, and he uses that both as a weapon against other people and a shield for himself. And I think that is what Robin Williams in this movie has to break through, is this idea that like he can be vulnerable, he can be weak. And that's one of the first things that I can't even think of. Is it Sean? Is that Robin Williams' name in this?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the first things that Sean says to him, is that, you've never experienced these things. You've never stood in front of someone completely vulnerable. Right.
Right.
And yeah, that's his kind of his worst fear.
Yeah, that's the other thing. The other thing I appreciate about this is Robin Williams' therapist character goes through some personal growth here as well.
Yeah.
Because I got the opinion that he, and this is a very typical male reaction to experiencing loss and grief, is he just very much withdrew. And he stopped, you know, like, and because of other, like, they imply that he was in Vietnam, right? And instead of like pursuing a brilliant career in psychology or whatever, he essentially dropped out of that to do grief counseling for soldiers and to be a good husband to his wife and to teach bored psychology students in this community, Boston Community College. And the other like characters kind of looked at him as a failure. And I is like, but you feel like that he kind of soldiered on. He didn't mind that. But then when he lost his wife, suddenly his colleagues didn't know really what to do or say. And suddenly he felt like, you know, maybe deep down and like some of he felt like, I don't know, that he had some regrets or he had some failures or, and he didn't know how to like express that. And by the end of the movie, you can kind of see that rift starting to heal. And it's because I think some of the stuff that Will said to him about like, well, you had a winning hand and you cash in your chips and you just walk away from the table after you crap out once, like that kind of hit home. Maybe you'll never find the love of his life again, but maybe he can reach out and start, you know, having a bigger life than just his classroom and his sad apartment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you want for him during this movie. I think it's probably what his wife would have wanted for him also. You have to imagine. Once she's gone. But I like how like the way that he like relates to himself kind of evolves over the course of this movie. Because he tells Stellan Skarsgård at one point, like all these things that I did were a conscious choice. It wasn't like I flamed out and I fucked up and I'm stuck in this terrible life that I hate now.
Right.
And I think that's true to a certain point. But there is a part of him also that has not been a choice, that he's not been acknowledging, which is the part where you said he withdrew. Like, I believe that he wanted to go help all these veterans, that he wanted to teach this community college. That's a conscious choice. The conscious part, though, ends where he is not living a life outside of that.
Yeah, and for similar reasons to Will, because like he felt like the way Will was trapped in Boston because he felt loyal, a misguided sense of loyalty to his friends, felt like if I get out, if I escape this, if I exceed them, if I do better than them, then that's not honoring our friendship and our loyalty and our memories of each other. And I feel like Robin Williams felt the same way about his wife. It's like, this is my love of my life and the light of my life. And that's gone out and I'm just going to live in darkness now because obviously it's the light of my life. It went out. And like, if what if I do move on? And maybe, and again, maybe not in feet, but like, what if I just move on with my life and, you know, try to go back to counseling and the soldiers and reconnect with my friends? Like, is if I move on and I get new light, is that disrespecting my wife? That's something that he's genuinely bad in the middle of a battle with at the beginning of this movie. Mm-hmm. And is fascinating kind of watching him work through that through the lens of helping Will.
Yeah. What do you make of the painting that he painted? Because I have some ideas on what I think this painting is more about. Will kind of identifies it as like a man who's thrashing around and struggling in a situation he can't control. And I see that element of it, but I also see a man who is like paddling into a situation he understands is chaotic and hard and dangerous. Yeah. But it's paddling into it nonetheless.
Reminds me of that Churchill quote, like if you are stuck in or if you're walking through hell, keep going. Or if you're going through hell, keep going.
Okay.
Because like, you know, like the Will sees this as a man floundering on the sea, where it's also a man who's just still rowing despite everything. He's still trying to make that forward. He's still trying.
Yeah. And he completely misidentifies the situation, right? He's like, oh yeah, your wife left you, you're a failure, all these things. It's like, no, right. None of that is true, but
right.
Sure, kid.
But that's a defense mechanism. Like, he tries to push everyone away, except for Ben Affleck, who weirdly enough pushes him away. But like, yeah. It was really, like, there was a couple scenes where, that one scene where he just kind of like violently pushes Minnie Driver away from his life, where she says, well, tell me you don't love me and, you know, I'll be out of your life forever. And he like hits her with that and she's devastated. Mm-hmm. That was genuinely painful to watch.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, this, and you understand why,
you because know it's not like, true.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, my God, what if I move to California? What if I leave? You know, what if I, you know, I'm going to I got this one faulty assumption that I'm doing this to honor my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I got another faulty assumption, which is I can never work out. If this girl truly authentically knows me and knows how broken I am, she's going to reject me and see me as the ugly thing that I am. And the only the thing is, like, it's a perfectly logical reaction if those facts are true. You know, right. You're just saving yourself from future pain. It's like, oh, well, this is fun. But now it's going to get to where I could get hurt. So push the eject button.
Yeah.
But it's not true.
No, it's obviously not true. She knows it. He knows it. Everybody involved, the audience knows it. And I think that's why it works so well. And so it's so affecting, is because this man is making a decision that feels right to him, that is clearly wrong. And you understand why he would make those decisions. Like, I think about a kid in an orphanage. Like I said earlier, he can't show weakness or he's going to get cigarettes put out on him. He's going to get bullied and beaten and abused like he was. And so he develops this distance between people as an emotional defense mechanism. And now he's just stuck with that. He doesn't know how to get out of it. And the movie is like a systematic deconstruction of that by his therapist, Sean. And I think that's like where the movie is best, is like how it's breaking down each and every element of that defense mechanism and disarming it. It's actually, I think, really good. I just, you know, the movie has like a sort of Pollyanna thing at the end where it's just like, well, he's going to be okay now. And that's like, okay. Well, he's probably got quite a few more years ahead of him of like struggling with the thing that he now recognizes before he's fully healed. But yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, like it's not a sure thing that him and Minnie Driver are going to be okay.
Totally.
You know, because he's got like, and you know, the other thing is like, they don't really examine this, but like, you know, probably Minnie Driver has some kind of level of trauma. She lost her father at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly she's like, I think in part, like so driven to push herself to justify that in investment she had, and like to like, yeah, I mean, like I said, this is all kind of unspoken, but like I could see that going out in California and just flying apart.
She's studying so hard, right? Mm-hmm. Does that feel like, oh, I can't waste the thing, the remnants of my father here?
And she kind of, I think there's a even thing where she addresses that, like, you know, if I, you know, you think I'm privileged to be here, and I guess I am, But like, mm-hmm. I would give all this money back right now, and I would give all the schooling and all this advanced education to have my father back in my life for these past 5, 6, 7, however many years it was. And to me, the unspoken thought is that, like, and since I can't do that, I have to make this worth it. I have I have to, you know, live up to the high price. This was bought very dearly. I have to make sure that I make the most of myself. Mm-hmm. And she's getting, she's also, her dad died young. I don't think, they didn't say it was like for a drunk drive or something. I assumed it was some kind of disease. I think it's telling she's getting to a medical field. Like, they couldn't save my daddy, but by God, I'm going to save some daughters. So there's like a ton of things. And I don't know how smart the script actually is about that, but like, yeah, there's a lot to wear. But you can also, sometimes people, when they get in those situations, it's not super common, but sometimes people can have like those complementary traumas where you can actually heal together. That's a beautiful thing too. So I don't know, but like, yeah, it's you said it best when you said the movie taps out right when the hard work would begin.
Right. Yeah. He recognizes the problem. Now he's got to fix it.
You have your first breakthrough in therapy, and then you're done. No. That's usually when you are at your most in pain, and it hurts the worst, and you are at the most loss. And but then you can, you know, you can unlearn all your defense mechanisms and all your maladaptive coping strategies, and genuinely start some sort of healing process. But I don't know. Did you want when he's driving off to California, did you want like Mordor hours. Style storm clouds to kind of let you know that Sam and Frodo are going, it's like, oh, this is the end of fellowship, you know?
No, I want Good Will Hunting 2 and
Hunt Harder.
Yeah. And I want to go back 10 years and have Robin Williams do it again. Yeah. I don't know.
Good Will Hunting 2. Bad Will Gathering.
Sure. I wanted to ask you something that I truly don't understand in this movie. And it has to do with like Minnie Driver's medical quest. So she's studying like organic chemistry or whatever, and she is trying desperately to understand it and grasp it. And it comes so easy to Will. He's just like, I can give you the answer. We can go on a date.
Right.
And she's like, no, I have to actually understand this stuff. I don't have your gift. What the fuck is Will's gift? Because Will says, like, I don't play piano. He compares himself to like Beethoven. He says, I don't play piano like Beethoven did, but I understand something intuitively like he did. What is that thing? Because it's not just math. Organic chemistry is not just math. Is he, I mean, he's the ultimate Gary Sue.
That's the Gary Stu aspect is kicks in right there, because like they should have, if they wanted to be a little bit more grounded character, they should have had to been a very narrow like math, maybe and applied math, you know, economics. But like the fact that he was an expert in history and was engaging in like pre-Marxian 16th century analysis of the colonial, like, what the fuck? Like that.
He clearly has like the ability to absorb and recall information on like on tap just instantly, because you see him reading in the very first shots of the movie and he's flipping page. So he does have a photographic memory, and
he even cites the exact page of some obscure pre-colonial capitalism thing, like page 98. And I'm like, but you're right. If he's like a genius polymath. But they try to pass it as like he's almost a savant. And I wonder if that's because like.
But a savant in everything is the problem.
Did you read any about the development of the script?
A tiny bit.
From what I gather, this was essentially written as like the Bourne Identity, that Matt Damon was a super intelligent kid that was on the run from the military. And it was this thriller. And
was he on the run from the military? I thought the military, like the government, was trying to recruit him.
Well,
like,
okay,
not really on the run, but he was hounded by them.
If the government wants you, and I wonder how much of this stuff is like earlier remnants of that draft. He was almost some kind of like science fiction type genius, and then they kind of wanted to pair that back, but they didn't go through and clean up necessarily everything. I don't know, because that kind of sticks in my
is probably a remnant.
Yeah, that sticks. The Matt Damon said the only scene that survives intact is the first time he meets Robin Williams. Like that is exactly how it went. And that's the only thing that from his rough draft survived pretty much unwritten, unrewritten, unchanged. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. Cause yeah, you're right that a lot of that stuff felt out of place. But I don't know, like the NSA stuff, it's like, okay, you could be a stockbroker with this knowledge. You could be a cryptographer with that knowledge. You could, yeah. But the fact that he is almost like a superpower and very undefined, kind of sticks in my craw too.
Yeah, bugged me a little bit.
I want to talk about the love story between Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, because this is a truly selfless love. That like this is I'm telling my best friend that he should abandon me because I want him a better shot. Have a better shot at life, mm-hmm. And I watched this movie and I was looking at like every time Matt Damon is kind of fucking around. Like there's a certain cast that Ben Affleck's face takes on, and it's just kind of like wincing, kind of disapproval, kind of like, I'm not sure about that. And it's like very subtle, and it grows throughout the movie. And it comes to its climax in that scene where they're, you know, drinking beers after work. And there's this great speech he gives where it's like, the best part of my day is when I pull up to your shithole house and I honk the horn. And I hope for those brief seconds until you do that, you're not going to be there, that you mm-hmm. you are going to have fucked off and gotten away from this and you're going to escape. And when he actually pulls up at the end of the movie and goes through that, I think that's actually a really, really strong performance.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, because like, go ahead. I don't want you to cut you off. I'm sorry.
No. You weren't cutting me off. I was going to say I actually think Ben Affleck is not a bad actor. He just kind of he's got a thing about him that makes him kind of punchable. He plays a lot of assholes, that kind of thing.
The thing is like this, you hear about Nick Cage like really lobbying to be Superman, and you see him in pictures of the suit and stuff. And it's like, why the fuck did you ever think you could pull this off? For some reason, people let Ben Affleck do that shit. Oh, yeah. You want to be Daredevil? Yeah, be Daredevil, Ben. You want to be Batman? Yeah, be Batman. But you want to do this self-indulgent relationship picture with your girlfriend J-Lo? Yeah, fucking do that. Yeah, fucking write her as a lesbian that you're gonna win her over to your side. Like, no one ever tells Ben Affleck, God. Nah. No one sees the screen test for him in the Daredevil suit. It's like, nah. So he just like his career a lot more than Matt Damon has been stepping on just one rake after another. Mm-hmm. But he also, like I said, he does good work on both sides of the camera. But I just wanted to, yeah, that scene where I was just watching him and he goes like, cause like, this is his dream, right? But like when he's confronted with the reality, it's kind of devastating. It's like, oh my God, Will left. Oh my God, this is my best friend. He's gone. I might never see him again. Mm-hmm. And, but then there's also the underlying, but I love my friend and I'm so happy for him that he's escaped this fucking situation.
Assuming he's not like dead in a gutter or something. True. Right? Like there's that possibility too that he doesn't consider, but yeah.
The NSA catches up to him and puts him in a laboratory. But no, I thought that was a really, really nice piece of work by Ben and throughout the film.
Yeah. Now, I don't know why if he's leaving, he can't have like a conversation that said, hey, yeah, I thought about what you said. I got to get out of here. It's been great. You know, I'll come back for you. I'll come back sometime and see you. Why they have to have it to where he just leaves without saying a goodbye. Just
it
like
is a fantasy.
Speech.
It is a fantasy.
I know, but come on.
That. If he, that's the thing is if he goes out there, he makes it big. I think he should come back for all of his homies and bring them up with him. But
sure.
Or I don't know about Casey Affleck. He seems like a crate. He seems like, if you got to, you know, I grew up in a poor rural town in Indiana and I had some colorful friends. I've had some friends with impulse control issues. And if I got rich, there'd be like, yeah, obviously. Yeah, we're working out together. Right.
Sure.
Every fourth friend or so is too. they're not going to be able to fit onto life raft. Their own fucking damage is going to either bring you down with them or bring themselves down. And I feel like that's Casey Affleck in this movie. This guy is a nut. Oh, yeah. My God. Who jerks off in your friend's parents' bedroom just because they got the only VCR that you know? Ah, Casey.
Yeah. Ben Affleck's kind of a nut in this movie, too. He instigates one of the more serious fights in this movie.
Which one?
And he forces Morgan, Casey Affleck, to go fight. It's the one where they see the guy who used to beat up Matt Damon.
I thought that was Matt Damon instigating that fight, saying that he wanted to do it. And Ben was just going along with it.
You might be right. But he forces Morgan to get out of the car. He's like, if you don't get out of the car and beat their asses, I'm coming for you next. Yeah.
I mean, that's the great and terrible thing about the Friends of the Poor impulse control is like what Robin Williams says is like any one of these guys would, you know, beat you to death with the bat on his say so. But like, and that sounds awesome. Like you got your own personal army, but they're going to get you into 10 times as many scrapes as they get you out of. So at the end of the day, it's like a fault. It's tends to be a false economy. Unless everybody grows up. But yeah, I thought that was great. And it's like the love story kind of culminates in his friends build him essentially an escape pod. And I think at some level they know, right? That like this is what that's what I got out of this watch of the movie is it's like at least the two smarter friends kind of knew they were provide. This is going to be his rowboat that he gets in and paddles out of this rough water. And I thought that they definitely. There's that awareness.
Oh, yeah. And the thing that kills me is I think his name's Morgan. Casey Affleck's character is so oblivious to this stuff and the actual like relationship mechanics here that when he realizes Matt Damon isn't coming, he jumps out of the car, sprints to the passenger side and says shotgun and jumps. He doesn't literally say shotgun, but. That's his first impulse is not to think. And you look at the guy in the back who's like processing what this means, right? Alongside Ben Affleck. And he doesn't make a motion to like say, you fucking idiot. Like our friend just left. We're never going to see him again. How callous of you. He's just back there thinking about the times they had, thinking about what it meant to him. He's like actually feeling the effect of this first case. He's just jumping in the front seat.
Yeah. We talked about a lot about Robin Williams being not Robin Williams in this film. I want to talk about a little bit of his physicality because the thing that makes this movie work is that him and Will have this, you know, they came from the same rough neighborhood. They're both beaten, you know, by father figures and they have a lot of the same scars. But like Robin Williams portrayed as like physically tough. Like he mentions that he can bench. I guess what I'm asking, he almost strangles Will. Do you think Robin Williams can bench 285?
I mean, he's Popeye, so yeah.
I was looking at it, even in these sweaters and his corduroy, he's built like a fucking chimpanzee. I think Robin Williams could throw up 285 in this movie, and it's kind of terrifying. I think Goodwill believes that he can throw up through 285.
Everybody looks surface deep on Robin Williams and comments on the hair. The hairy arms, but you got to go deeper to really understand Robin Williams. Yeah. It's all about his musculature.
Yeah. Like he looks like the kind of guy that Joe Rogan would be like, Jamie, call up some video of this guy. Look at this animal, you know?
He does seem like he is well built in this movie. I don't know how old he is. He's got to be.
That's a good question. In his 50s, going on late 50s? No. Oh man, maybe. that's a damn good question. I don't know. The thing is like, so I think he sells the blue collar rough aspect of everything. There's one scene that like really lands flat, and I don't know if it's because it's kind of like, you know, transphobic and that's gauche but like, you know, it's kind of like when Clint Eastwood is like busting his Polish friend's balls in the barbershop in Gran Torino. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's like, oh, it's this old man who fought in the Korean War. Turns out he's super old and racist. And like Clint Eastwood nails that because Clint Eastwood probably certainly super old, almost certainly racist. So he pulls that off. Robin Williams doesn't really pull that like. Joking, you know, like busting someone's bust, but it feels forced in a way that I don't think that man from the South, he'd went through the Vietnam War and all that, like would do that. And I kind of wish they'd left that line out or gave him something else to do, because but maybe, in fact, it struck me so much I rewound and watched a couple times. Like, does this not work because this material sucks and it's offensive? Does it not work because Robin Williams just doesn't have this gear to him? Or does it not work because he is that guy, but he's just going through the motions?
Hmm.
Like, his heart's not in the Southie bullshit anymore because it's broken.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I see, is like him trying on who he used to be in that moment. Like, yeah. And not seriously, but like, maybe it's just him trying to identify better with his patient, to like, because he's trying out his jokes too, right? That scene begins with him telling the joke that Matt Damon told him in his office to the bartender, I think. Mm-hmm. Before, yeah. Stellan Skarsgård shows up, I think that's a scene that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to me, it's like a little bit of Will maybe sparking this older person that he used to be within him again. And I hope that's not what he plans to do at the end of the movie. Like, he's going to go, like, Will has inspired him to become a Southie again, and he's going to travel the country telling blowjob jokes and dribbling beer out of his mouth, and like
go to bars and beat up kids in ponytails and
right
with his monkey man strength.
Yeah, I hope that's not what he plans to do. Like, it hasn't rekindled that in him.
Yeah, no, I think it's more of like he's ready to, again, his life is never going to be the same. He's never going to be the same after he loses his wife. That piece is always going to be missing. But like, he still has life to live. He still has things he can give back to people. He's no longer going to push people, the people that care him away, care about him away.
Yeah.
I thought some of the insights they had on relationships, that's the things that serve, like, that's stuff that like is the realest shit. Like, I think, I don't know, I go back and forth about how I think this film portrays therapy. It's wild because like Robin Williams is a dead ringer for my best, like the best therapist I ever had. Like, down to the dress, down to the beard, down to the hair, down to even like the way they speak. It's insane. But like, I think this is a highly dramatized process. God, where's I going with that? Overall, it's like, I'm not sure, like, if this is pro, I guess it's pro mental health, but like, it's a very I think it's a very misleading, you know, not just from the Pollyanna ending, but like, it is a lot of, it's very just so in that too, you know.
Yeah.
You gain the trust, you have the breakthrough, you have the acting out moments, you got, you know, it's,
And the movie starts out like so much fun. Right. You've got Will solving these advanced math problems as a janitor. Like, how can he do this? He's
power fantasies. Yeah,
right. He's getting one up on the Harvard kids at the bar. And you're really on his side for the vast majority of the beginning of this movie. And for me, the place that it turns is that scene with the robot painting. Because they've just established in the scene before that Robin Williams' wife died. And so Will comes in here and starts talking mess about something he has no knowledge of. And he turns in that scene from the protagonist to the antagonist in my mind. And now Robin Williams is kind of the antagonist.
Yeah, there's a lot of deep stuff in that, too, because like, you know, did Robin Williams withdraw from the grief counseling with the soldiers because he's withdrawing, which probably did? Or is it just like that he found it impossible to deal with guys? You know, like, what, you know, like, he can't interface with his pain because he's in so much pain himself. Because, like, yeah, I think that's one thing that, like, started his whole process. The idea that Will was able to get to him to the point that he's, like, going to physically assault this kid who's already been beaten, abused, and all that other kind of stuff. Like, I think that disturbed Robin Williams, is like, oh, my God, how fucking weak have I become that I let, you know, this kid that doesn't know shit about shit, rattle me like that.
Is his reaction to it is not to get defensive, it's to examine it, right? To hold it up, to look at it and say, yeah, this is a part of me. Why do I feel this way? Why did this kid make me feel this way, saying these things? Whereas, you know, Will is going to do the exact opposite. It just shows like the more advanced, the maturity that the movie is pointing out, right? Like, you haven't lived these things, I have. And you haven't considered or dealt with these things, and I have. And so I have a better approach to it.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
I want to talk about Minnie Driver. Because I found her character extremely, like, I remember back in the day, like, oh my God.
Relentlessly is like, cute is how I would
this
describe
is like
her
my,
in this
like
movie.
A dream girl.
Sure.
But as I was watching, I was like, it, you know, like, you got the stereotypical, like, manic pixie dream girl. Like, it's like, you know, she exists only to be the fulfillment of a male fantasy. Is Minnie Driver's character a little bit like that? Because, like, I was looking for that. I'm like, you know, this feels like a real woman to me.
The only way in which I think it is a bit like that is that she is a multimillionaire. Like Will has no money. If he were to quit his job and move to California with some college girl,
she could completely support him. And
right. Their lives are totally fine from a financial perspective.
Yeah.
Like a college orphan girl, right? Like, by all rights, yeah, she shouldn't really have all this money in this stage of her life, but she does, and so she's like this fantasy. Yeah, but in other ways, but, yes, I think you're right. It's much better.
But I think it's also even that is an impediment to her relationship with Will, because that just heightens his inferiority.
True.
Like, I think he would prefer her be penniless and driven, you know, rather than she's loaded and driven. Mm-hmm. But like, also, like, the thing is like, she also doesn't really cater, you know, like when Will has these gross, inappropriate reactions, she, I think, reacts realistically with like, you know, like she's sad, but she's not going to like chase this guy. She's not going to like, you know, bait or like put, she's not going to put up with it either. So it's like, yeah, there's a little bit of that, like pushback. I don't know. I take this for what it is as a middle-aged man, but she came across as a very well-written character. If anything, she's extremely attractive in like almost every aspect a person can be attractive in. And even
she likes to have fun. She's silly. You know,
yeah,
that's something I find attractive.
But she's also not frivolous because she's, you know, she takes her career, you know, her schooling serious, all that kind of stuff. Did I miss out on a joke?
No, you didn't. I was just thinking about that scene where she puts the glasses on, goofy eyeglasses.
How can you not love her?
Me up every time. Yeah.
Yeah. She's just like doing all this prop comedy. Mm-hmm. Ah, so good.
They destroy that poor woman's store. Like, they're rummaging through all the crap. Matt Damon throws a handful around. Of caramels on the ground. That lady has to pick up all that stuff.
That's such a great line, too, where she suggests we get coffee. He says, oh, we can just eat a bunch of caramels. You know, that's as random as drinking coffee. Like, that's a good fucking point, you know?
I guess. Culturally, it's not, though. Come on,
I know.
Dude.
It's a public area where you're not going to murder the woman where you meet her for the first time, Matt, okay? Eating caramels is maybe not going to accomplish
that. Americans don't get up and have two cups of caramel in the morning. They get up and they have coffee. That's a culturally relevant meeting point. Come on.
I was looking for things as I was watching because, like, you know, a lot of times people, if they criticize our coverage, they're like, oh, you guys talk about the characters and themes and the big picture too much. I wish you guys talked more about the cinematography and the sound and all kind of stuff like that. Ooh. So I've been trying to, especially with the prestige stuff, look for that stuff more. I don't know whether it's because I went on my own little personal Quentin Tarantino film fest. The last five nights I've watched Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, Reservoir Dogs, and Pulp Fiction last night. But like, this movie seems very buttoned down and pedestrian, like in terms of its sound, in terms of its music, in terms of it's a meat and potatoes film after the Willy Wonka that I've been watching. So I don't know, like, their one grace note that I thought was really excellent, actually, was that transition they make from the NSA interview to Robin Williams' office. That was pretty fucking slick. It neatly avoided
where they just cut to the same angle of Matt Damon. He's sitting in a different chair,
and you imagine he's just reciting what he says, and like normally you would see him give that to the NSA guys. They see their flustered reaction, and then he'd be talking. So anyway, that's what I told him, Robin. I like this because you're waiting for the reaction shot of the three shocked businessmen that are getting the NSA agents getting their asses handed to it, and it's Robin Williams. And you didn't even realize that they switched offices because they keep on pushing in and pushing in on Matt's face. And then at one point they start retracting. I thought that was very effective, and I haven't seen that before. You know, you've seen that a million times. I've never seen it like inverted Memento style.
I like it. How do you feel about the Ben Affleck, I guess, showcase scene, which is him dressed up in an ill-fitting suit,
God,
sports socks, boat shoes, and greased down hair?
I think I saw Jordan Peterson looking like this last week, crazy enough.
Jesus. Okay.
Did you see that outfit that he was strutting around in?
I didn't, but wow.
Dude, that was like, it's so ballsy too. You've gotten this meeting with this Merrill Lynch, you know, big ball stockbrokers, and you send Ben Affleck to pretend that you're yourself. Mm-hmm. And he's accidentally got you a $90,000 a year job that he's going to walk out on, and they put $200 of drinking money in his pocket as a favor. It's just, it's such a fucking ridiculous scene, but it's hilarious. I love it.
If I'm one of these executives or whoever he's meeting with, what am I thinking in that moment? Because his reputation precedes him, right? You've been told by a well-respected colleague, this man is brilliant.
Yeah, by like not just a respected colleague, by essentially a super Nobel laureate.
Right, Right. Has told you that this is an incredibly intelligent man. You've got to be thinking, what trap is he setting here? He's acting like a fucking idiot. He's talking a bunch of nonsense. What am I walking into?
Yeah, are we the assholes? Are we like, right. did we do something? Yeah, like, and all three of those guys are like totally like, I don't want this to be happening. Well, how can we make this stop? It's really funny.
And I think, yeah, Ben Affleck walks out of that meeting with $73 in his pocket.
And a check.
And that's it. That's it. These guys just got swindled out of $73. They'll never see him again.
Which, that's the hilarious thing, is like, it's such a small-minded crime too, because he could have gotten away with.
Oh my God. When he's saying retainer, and then he asked for $200.
$200.
Dude, you got to ask for 40, 50 grand. Easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then you get brought up on charges instead of just taking the money in their wallet. They're like, nah, we're suing your ass.
It's so funny when you said this is the Ben Affleck stand, the showcase scene, because I'm like, I thought we just talked about the best part of my day, and then you hit me with the retainer. Have we talked about this pre-show? On a scale of one to full-on offensive cultural appropriation, what is it when two rich upper-class kids that are Harvard educated and who are going to get their first script greenlit for $750,000. What is it when they affect this really working class background accent, probably people that they've mocked and looked down on their whole lives? Is that, I mean, it's acting, right? It's not full on minstrelly. I don't want to, but it's something, right? It's blue collar appropriation.
And then get paid $600,000 each for the roles. Yeah, for acting.
To make your millions doing that.
I don't know. Because I mean, you're right. If they were in blackface, it'd be very easy to like go, well, this is completely wrong.
Sure.
But I don't know.
There's levels to the oppression game, and there is a level that's played that maybe not everyone sees between poor whites and rich whites, you know, and, you know, people that have education, people that don't have education, people that have classy cultural indicators and people that do, you know, that are born with rough working class backgrounds. I didn't come here today expecting to talk to this, because I thought the legend was, I think this was an intentionally put out, that Ben and Matt were from this kind of like more working class background, that like they're just like that this Goodwill Hunting thing is like these just rags to riches story. Mm-hmm. And like so many of these others, I hear it turns out to be bullshit. I mean, like I said, I'm not saying it's offensive. It's just like, makes me go,
Yeah, I mean, Matt Damon was attending Harvard when he started writing this script as a play. So,
yeah. Yeah,
it's
dad's
hard.
A stockbroker. Mom was a professor at Harvard, but I bet that helped it with admissions.
right. Yeah. And I'm sure they know people in the industry. Yeah. And
Ben Affleck, it's like they talked about his dad being an alcoholic, and again, like that's rough. But like he went from what was it? He went from Berkeley, and then his parents moved to Cape Cod.
OK.
So I don't know. It's like I think it's interesting. It's interesting to kind of raise my eyebrows, because again, I think at the time, and this is a Harvey Weinstein bullshit, like, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, oh my God. The other thing about the Tarantino is like, I see the Weinstein production, and it's like, every time it's like snaps you, it's like, oh my fucking God, that's such a disgraced brand at this point.
Right.
But, I wonder, I don't know. I wonder if that was an angle that he pushed in the publicity, because it seems to be entirely fabricated. But I also, this is almost 30 years ago, so I don't know how much of that is me making the inference that, you know, oh, these are some poor kids that made good versus the reality, or if they actually kind of leaned into that. I feel like it's the latter, in which case that's where it's like, that kind of sucks, guys.
Yeah.
Stolen valor.
I have a lot of like, stuff like that in my life where I've watched a piece of media and it gets confused with reality in some ways. And so I went to look up the etymology of how about them apples. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that
it's
is
deeply
a phrase
offensive to the Boston Irish people.
Right.
So and they would know that if they.
I feel like that's a phrase that is like inherently mixed up with real life and movies, because I couldn't find a straight answer on where it came from, because it's such a nonsensical thing, right? It doesn't actually make any sense if you think about it, which is true of so many idioms. But a lot of idioms have roots in real world things. Sure. The closest I've found for how about them apples is in World War One. There was a type of mortar that kind of looked like an apple, and they called them
Apple Jacks.
No, they call them like apple dandies, apples or
candied
toffee apples. Toffee apples.
Oh, okay. Fucking Brits.
Probably, yeah. And so, like, they would put them, they would load them into the artillery or whatever, fire them off, and say, "How about them apples?" And that made it into a movie. Well, I don't know that made it into the movie, but there was also a movie, Rio Grande, where they did that in the film. And now I'm looking at it and I'm saying, okay, do people know the etymology of this because they know it, or because they saw this movie and got it confused with the reality of the thing?
Plus, there's also these false, you know, etymologies where it's like it's people kind of essentially reasoning on what they might think it is. And it's like, yeah, it has no relation at all.
Right. And then I wonder how many people only know "How About Them Apples" from this movie.
I don't know. I don't know how I like those apples, Jim. What is it about the British and fruit based obscure slang? Because like one of my favorite British isms is something has gone pear shaped. And I've seen all kinds of etymologies ranging from like that's the shape of a collapsed parachute when you're parachuting over enemy lines and it means it's a bad situation, to like all kinds of stuff. But like there's been no definitive, but it's like, but pear shaped. It's so satisfying. It's by every time I say it, I have no fucking idea what it means. Just it's gone pear shaped. Situation's got fucked. It's foobar. It's pear shaped.
No,
how do you like them apples? It's gone pear shaped.
I like them apples.
I don't like them pears shapes. What else do we want to? There's got to do other random. I'm to the like random observation stage of my notes. I don't know where you're at. So if you got anything substantive, speak now.
Nope.
Chalkboard magic. My jaw dropped. I love those flippable, movable, slidable, full classroom chalkboards that Stellan Skarsgård's operating. Those fucking things are rad. I've always, like instead of getting a ladder and writing up there, just like drag that bitch down. And then when you're done, throw it back up for the people in the base. Yeah, it was cool. I didn't even know they made those things. Awesome.
Well, they probably don't anymore. How do you feel about like digital chalkboards, whiteboards?
I think they're the wave of the future. Wave of the future.
I mean, they are. They're installed at all these high level colleges.
Yeah, I remember like my jaw dropping the first time I saw one of those in my son's, like they got a new school when he was like in fourth grade.
Wow.
All the classrooms had those digital active chalkboards. And it's like, fuck, yeah, this is beats the hell out of beating the erasers at the end of the day. And remember, did you ever have to do that detail, that duty where you had to wipe down the chalkboards? And
And you take the erasers outside and get chalk all over your face? Yeah, no, thank you.
I can feel the feel of my fingernails touching chalk. To this day, it's like being in the dentist chair. But if you have to have a chalkboard, make one of these magic ones.
When you have to shake out the digital erasers, those things, God. You never get the digital bits off your face.
Yeah,
or
hands. You have to reboot it. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Also, I thought that Jack and Nimish must feel really good. Because, like, when Skarsgård comes outside his theater or his class and he sees the first equation done, and, like, there's this ring of students kind of, like, looking around, and he's like, Jack? Nimish? And they're like, oh, not us. But that must mean that he thinks they're the two smartest guys in the class, right? That's like
or
unofficial.
Just the guys that were standing near the chalkboard.
That's the unofficial top G's in that department. And you might not... Skarsgård seems like the type of guy to never let you know that unless you are an attractive woman, which...
There's a flirt
really
in this movie that's like couple
where it makes it seem like this rock star mathematician is just cutting a swath through his underclass women, and like that aged a bit poorly because
the
like,
opportunities that Indiana Jones turns down, this man accepts.
Yes, and the hell of it is like I remembered him as being kind of a villainous character, and he is a bit of an antagonist, but like, I don't think the film takes like this guy as a sleazeball, but he is a sleazeball. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the film, you're like, oh, this guy's nice, and I'm glad to see Robin Williams, but like, this guy's going to get brought up on charges in 15 years. Point blank, period. I don't care how fucking tenured. I don't care how many super Nobel yeah. math prizes he's got. That shit ain't going to fly in 2010, buddy.
He enjoys success in all its forms. And sometimes that form is women.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. I mean, he seems like a very charming, attractive, urbane guy. I think he could go out and get women on his own horsepower. I don't think you need to mm-hmm. hit on your 23-year-old co-eds, but...
Yep.
That's all I got, man. Jack and Nimish, they're top guns in that department. They're Maverick and Goose.
The math problems in this are so advanced to me that I don't even recognize them as math. Like, he's just drawing squiggles on the board.
That second one is an Uncharted puzzle. Nah, yeah. It's not math. It's an Uncharted puzzle. It's how many palm fr- you gotta match the palm fronds on the back of the silver coin that Nathan Drake's got. Yeah, that's not math. There's no fucking way. No fucking way that's math. I heard that that's something I read. And I don't quote me on this. If there's a real mathematician out there, I hear you guys are all rock stars and emotionally fragile. So I don't want any smoke from this. But I've heard, according to Wikipedia, these are actually pretty mid-level pedestrian math equations. They are not like, which is sure. wild.
But because
like
a movie going public that.
Yeah.
My God.
But you don't even have to have right math for the move. Like 99% of the people, uh-huh. if you got to like, you know, one level beyond introductory calculus, it's going to be impenetrable. So
you
like,
could draw a picture of Winnie the Pooh up there and I would not know it's not yes. math because the movie is telling me it's math.
Yes. Oh, yes. This is the Eeyore theorem. It's right. Unproven until
first but that's postulated the thing, it's like, by Tom and Jerry. Tom and Jerry are the name of the mathematicians in this. Did you recognize that? Did you hear
no,
it?
No, I didn't.
Jerry
oh
is
God.
The is Stellan Skarsgård's name, and his assistant is Tom.
Gotcha. That's hilarious. No, I wondered, because like there's real life very hard to prove theorems and like unproven theorems. I don't know why they. I guess you can't do an unproven theorem, because then how do you do this?
Right.
Yeah, that's the one thing yeah. where the mathematicians would take off their cashmere scarves and buck up their emotional fragility and be like, how dare you say that? But like, yeah, no, yeah. it's apparently it's just kind of run the mill math.
Yep.
Well, is this all we have to say about the Goodwill Hunting?
I think so.
I hope he finds what he's hunting for out in California. All right. So that'll do it for Goodwill Hunting. Next week, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. It's the 75th anniversary of the Humphrey Bogart classic Treasure of the Sierra Madre. It's widely regarded as one of the best movies of all time. It's got 100% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm kind of looking forward to it. It's a Jack Huston directed movie. I've actually never seen this before. It should be a treat. I'm really looking forward to see if a 75-year-old movie can hold up as well as a Good Will Hunting. Well, that's what we're going to be doing next week. I think that's something we didn't consult with the Patreon executive producers on, because it's an anniversary we wanted to fit in. But if you do want to help us choose our prestige films and have a say in some of the direction Bald Move's moving, join our squad of executive producers. You can find that at support.baldmove.com. You get tons of access to great benefits like ad-free feeds, premium audio content like our first-run movie reviews, our instant talks, our instant take sessions, live sessions. We're going to be doing those after at least a few of the Last of Us episodes, as well as Lunch with Jim and Aaron. All that at support.baldmove.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.